Foreclosures in the U.S. continue to rise. The foreclosure listing company RealtyTrack says foreclosure filings in May were up by nearly 50% compared to May of last year. RealtyTrack says one in every 483 households in the U.S. received a foreclosure filing last month. That's a second straight monthly record. Nevada, California, Arizona, Florida, and Michigan had the highest statewide foreclosure rates. Bank repossessions posted a double-digit increase over April. Legislation is being proposed in Congress that would give the Commodity Futures Trading Commission more resources to monitor oil futures trading. Many lawmakers believe speculators are partly to blame for the recent big oil price increases. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org.
We know that summer's a busy time, but please don't forget to support WILL before June 30th. If you've received a letter from us, please send it back right away or call 1-866-779-9455 to renew your membership or make an additional gift. Your support makes a big difference and keeps the news and information programs you depend on coming throughout the summer and all year long. Call 1-866-779-9455. Thanks.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting more Summer Studio Theater Company, as well as the Summer Solstice Celebration on June 20th, featuring a Star Lab and live music. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In the first hour today, we'll be looking at what past climate change might have to say as we think about climate change today and in the future. Back a ways, say between the 10th and 15th centuries, the Earth experienced a rise in average temperature, and it had global effects. In Western Europe, the effects were positive. This is a time that is called the medieval warm period, roughly from the year 800 to about 1300. Winters were mild, summers were long, it was very good for crops. That led to an increase in population and a flowering of culture in Europe. However, during this time, there were other places around the world that did not fare so well. In fact, other societies collapsed from long periods of drought. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Brian Fagan, in fact, argues that drought may well be the hidden and most dangerous element in global warming today. Brian Fagan is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's written a number of books on the interaction of climate and human society, and his most recent is titled The Great Warming: Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. The book is published by Bloomsbury and has been out for a little while now, has gotten a lot of attention, and we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us about the book this morning. Professor Fagan, hello.
Good morning. It's nice to be back in Champaign. I spent a year there in 1966.
Well, that was a little bit before my time, but on behalf of all the people of Champaign-Urbana and the university, well, we welcome you at least to be with us by phone. We'd certainly appreciate it.
Well, it's nice to be back.
Let's begin by talking about the warm period in Europe at this time that we're talking about. How, in fact, do we know, what good information do we have about what the temperatures were during this several hundred-year period?
It's really very interesting, because when I started to write this great warming book, I thought of medieval peasants with apple cheeks reveling in year after year of bountiful harvests, which I soon found out wasn't exactly true, because one of the great advances of the last 10 years in science has been climatology, and particularly the study of ancient climate using ice cores, using deep-sea cores for the longer sequences, and in particular tree rings, which are giving us a very sensitive indication of rainfall and temperature in Europe and elsewhere, with the result that in some places we can now even look at seasons. And it's clear that the medieval warm period wasn't universally warm. There was a trend, apparently, towards slightly higher temperatures, about 1.5 degrees centigrade, less rainfall in the summer, a little less rainfall, and a longer growing season, which in Europe was very important because that tended to allow the growth of more grain and to grow grain further north. For example, they were growing cereals in Norway, and they were growing wine or vines in central England, so much so that they were exporting English wine to France, and the French were complaining about it. So the world was a little different. And, of course, as you said, the effects were, on the whole, beneficial.
Mm-hmm. This, I suppose, it points to the fact that when you're in the middle of some long period, you don't have the kind of perspective that you do with the long view, where you can actually see what's going on over long periods of time. Did people take note of what was happening, or did they really say very much about anything like, certainly this summer is different from last, or this summer is different from 10 years ago?
There is a dearth of information. What we do know, and this is something that's really come out of all this very heavily, is that most of Europe was at the subsistence level. People lived from one harvest to the next. And their only guide to climate were the observations they could make from the top of church towers, which has been called church steeple meteorology, which maybe is 24 to 36 hours. And, of course, they attributed anything, a good harvest or a bad one, to the will of God. And if it was a bad harvest, they had sinned. And like clockwork, you found penitential processions in the streets, flagellating themselves and begging for forgiveness for their sins in the hope there'd be a better harvest. Most people lived lives of brutally hard work. Life expectancy was in the late 20s, and everybody really at some point in their lives experienced hunger. And it was a very brutal existence. So in that sense, the medieval warm period was a matter of, thank goodness, we've got another good harvest. Mm-hmm. As they lived from year to year, and the consequences of it were, you know, given the background of it, this was uncertainty about the climate.
And as a result of this, of the greater agricultural productivity that was made possible by these beneficial overtime, these beneficial changes in the weather, this did indeed result in population increases?
It's very difficult to say that climate caused anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of a pebble dropping into a pond and the ripples going out or radiating out from the point of impact across the calm surface and then calming again, you get the kind of idea. Because a lot of the results were either social or economic, and many of them were subtle and took a long time. And the result is that we do know that population rose in this period, that as a result there was widespread deforestation, much of it at the hands of monastic communities who wanted isolation and forest clearings and yet had to feed themselves, and a great deal of marginal land was taken up on slopes and so on, which was very susceptible to erosion if there was heavy rain. And then in 1315, there were 7 years of really wet summers and bad harvests, and about 1.5 million people starved. So you were really living on the edge, mm-hmm. and the prosperity was sort of almost illusory in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly does point to something that was happening here, and I think that it happened other places as well, that we would probably argue now was not necessarily beneficial for the environment, and that is significant cutting down of trees.
It was a devastating blow, because what fell in front of the woods people's axes was the primordial forest of Europe, which had been there since the Ice Age, 10,000 or more years. And all the products it brought people who were living on the edge, game, wild plant foods, browse for pigs, and so on. And there were big debates and fights for centuries over the rights of forests, whether the king held them, the nobility, or local villages. And all this got very complicated. And so in a way, this was a drastic change in European life.
Well, what, given the fact, again, we want to make sure people understand here, we're talking about a period of several hundred years, and from one year to the next, and maybe even from one decade to the next, there were ups and downs. But overall, there was this trend that we have talked about that was good for agriculture. It was a period where there was population expansion.
It was indeed, yes. Generally, overall, it was a period of cities growing, the beginnings of cathedral building, endemic warfare, and in many ways the beginnings of the foundation of modern Europe. Yes, very much so. It was a beneficial period.
Now, just for contrast, let's turn and take a look at what was going on in a different part of the world during this same period. Let's look at the Americas, because here what was going on was very different from what was happening in Europe.
Ah, yes, and devastatingly different. We have in California, in the Sierras, and in Nevada and Utah, a very strong, very convincing evidence from tree rings of prolonged droughts. One of them, in about 1200, lasted 140 years. And the snowpack was less than 65% of normal. So you're talking about serious water shortages. Fortunately, at the time, there were very sparse populations over much of the West, most of them hunters and gatherers, and these people sort of moved with the drought. They would move into areas of more permanent water, move to higher altitudes, shift to different foods. And obviously there were casualties, but they seemed to have survived, and indeed in some cases prospered. But the effects on more settled communities, like the Pueblos of the Southwest, were very serious indeed. And you have cases like Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, where heavy droughts were a factor in the ancestral Pueblo abandoning the great Pueblos they built there and moving out into other communities where they had kin who were better watered, where they had more water. And this is part of the ancient tradition of Pueblo Indian oral tradition, which shows that movement in the face of drought was a very strong tradition. Mm-hmm. You're looking at people who were flexible, who you're used to living with drought, and accommodated their lives accordingly.
Mm. Well, that does suggest that here we're talking about changes that or trends that could persist across generations, across a long period of time, so that there would have been the opportunity for people to try to make some adjustments in the way that they lived. In what way? And I know in the book that you not only do you write about the southwestern United States, but you also talk about Latin America and the Maya, for example. These were people who did indeed develop a technological kind of approach to trying to deal with this problem.
You get into a very different scale of things when you get places or communities which are much larger than a large village. Hmm. Villages can move if push comes to shove, as indeed the ancestral Pueblo did. They moved family by family, probably. But when you get into large Maya ceremonial centers or the large cities, they were cities like Chan Chan in Peru on the coast, you're dealing with very, very different variables. And both the Maya and the Chimú had no illusions about the climate. They were used to the notion in Peru of drought most of the time, and in Maya country of unpredictable rainfall. And at that point, you get into a completely different variable, because there you really have to begin to have some political control of water management. And in the case of the Maya, there's been some brilliant new research done, which has focused for the first time on Maya water and the ways they conserved it. And by the end of their civilization, around the 10th century, they were beginning or were using their pyramids at the big centers, apparently, as what the researcher calls water mountains. Mm-hmm. Places, basically, that were used not only for ceremony, but they collected water which flowed into reservoirs, which those who controlled the water then rationed out to farmers living around the centers. This is in addition to extensive swamp farming and other forms of village agriculture, which had their own supplies of water, storage pits and reservoirs and so on. And in Maya society, was extremely hierarchical. It was ruled by an elite, which started off very small and then grew larger, and control of the water supplies was in the hands of Maya lords, who preached that they had very powerful supernatural powers which enabled them to intercede with the other world, with the ancestors in the other world. But when you get a drought which lasts more than about 2 or 3 years, and the water supplies around these centers could last for that long, you get into a situation where people who are told the gods are infallible and the kings or the rulers are infallible are going to turn around and say, hello, where's the water? And this politically, obviously, is thwart with risk. We can think of examples from our own times. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, I repeat, not the only reason, that Maya civilization began to implode down in the southern lowlands in the 10th century was because of a series of well-documented droughts, which we know of from cores bored into freshwater lakes and from a deep-sea core of Venezuela. In Peru, the Chimú knew they were going to have droughts. They lived with drought. It was their life. And they developed, again, rather centralized, highly organized irrigation systems, canals, which connected one valley to the next, very carefully rationed and conserved mountain runoff, which was the only water literally they had, and they apparently survived and thrived through the drought simply by controlling it all very, very carefully. So you've got a very different situation there where political considerations were of great importance.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Our guest is Brian Fagan. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's written a lot about the interaction of climate and human society, and his most recent book is The Great Warming. The subtitle is Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher, and it takes a look at what was going on around the world, roughly speaking from the 10th to the 15th centuries, where there was global climate change going on, and it looks at the effects. In some places they were positive, and some places not, around the world. The book is out now. If you want to take a look at it, you can certainly seek it out in the library or the bookstore. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And I guess makes me think about the subtitle of the book, that this particular issue, whether you have adequate water and whether you can produce enough food to feed people, certainly you could see how that would contribute perhaps to the rise and fall of civilizations, in the sense that if people can't be fed, you don't have a civilization, but also in the other sense, which I think is interesting as well, and that is that rulers justify their position in many places and times have justified their position by arguing that they had a direct connection to the gods. And as long as things were going well, that was good. But if things were not going well, then that's the kind of thing that can lead to the fall of civilizations, or at the very least to the fall of dynasties.
Yes, indeed. And the rulers, of course, in those days, and they didn't have the knowledge of history that we have now. I mean, this happened again and again. The classic example of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs of about 2180 B.C., who had always preached they controlled the floods of the Nile and were themselves living gods, and then there was about a century of catastrophically low Nile floods, and everyone thinks that ancient Egyptian civilization thrived on predictable Nile floods. In fact, the flood was highly unpredictable, and the difference between a large flood and a bad flood was only a few meters. And ancient Egypt fell apart for about a century because people lost faith in their central supreme pharaoh. And it was provincial governors who were strong leaders who kept things going.
We have a caller to talk with and bring into our conversation. Let's do that in the community of Belgium, not too far away, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I was going to ask the guest if he studied the Mississippian Indians of that period of time, the mound builders. They stretched all along the Ohio, the Mississippi, down into Georgia, not too much farther north than, Kankakee, Illinois. I don't think they went much higher than that. Didn't go much farther west than the Mississippi. They built large mounds. They seem to have lived all along the rivers. They had a form of agriculture. And they seem to have disappeared just about the same time you're talking about.
Unfortunately, I didn't study the Mississippian Indians for the purposes of this project. One of the reasons is that I didn't know a great deal about them. And secondly, a lot of the research on climate in that area is still very much in its infancy. But I believe there is new research coming out which is beginning to measure the effects of climate on Mississippian society, which must have been quite significant, I would imagine, given things like flood levels and so on. But it is being worked on, and I just apologize. It's not something that I'm up on, because most of the new research is coming out now as we speak.
Yes, the main area that I'm talking about is Cahokia, which happens to be right next to St. Louis. Well, thank you very much, sir.
I'm sorry I can't be more helpful on that.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you talked a little bit about Europe in this period, this period roughly speaking from the year 800 to 1300, what was happening in Europe, that it was a time, generally speaking, of warm weather, and that was good for agriculture, expansion of population and growth of culture. We've talked a little bit about what was happening in the southwestern United States and also in parts of Latin America where they were dealing with prolonged and serious droughts. What was happening during the same period of time? What was happening in Asia, particularly in West Asia?
This is the big gap in our knowledge, because research is only really now just beginning. There's a project going on at the moment to collect tree ring samples from a wide area of Eastern Asia, particularly, to attempt to measure what the effects of the medieval warm period and the succeeding Little Ice Age were. It is clear, however, that one of the major influences on Asian climate was the irregular cycles of La Nina and El Nino, which are considered now to be the second most major effect or influence on global climate over and above the passage of the seasons. So what is the link here is the failure or otherwise of monsoons. And it appears that during the medieval warm, monsoons were reasonably good, and places like India apparently did not suffer very much. But later on, when La Nina receded and El Ninos were more common, the effects were devastating. There is, for example, a magnificent study of climate and 19th century tropical farmers in India and Asia, which measures the effects of major El Ninos in the late 19th century. And this series of events and tropical droughts generally appear to have killed between, are you ready for this figure, 20 or 30 million people in the 19th century. Mm. All tropical farmers, most of them illiterate, and certainly off the historical radar screen. Mainline history really has not paid much attention to these casualties, which has a startling relevance to our own world, where the people who are at most risk, many of them, are subsistence farmers in arid and semi-arid regions. The area that apparently did suffer was northern China, where there has always been a drought problem, and again in the 19th century there were savage droughts, but this is a big area. We know there were droughts up in the medieval warm time up in northern China, but we don't really know the effects of them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to give you a rather vague reply, we just don't know.
Yeah. One thing that we know certainly now is that the issue of climate change, global climate change, is a topic of current interest, debate, and discussion. And it seems that there is general agreement on the fact that there has, over the last century or so, been something like a 1 degree average rise in global temperature of 1 degree. And that we also see significant warming within the past couple of decades, and also we're now starting to see environmental impacts in various places of that warming. That doesn't seem to be disputed disputed. What people continue to argue about, however, is why this has happened and to what extent human activity contributes. And a lot of people have argued that it is human activity in the form of burning fossil fuels, and that has produced a lot of greenhouse gas, and that has had this effect on the atmosphere, and that has led to the warming and so forth. If we look back to this period now that we're talking about here, though, and we ask questions about, well, why do we think this happened? Obviously, here you can't pin this on human activity. This has to be completely natural. Do climatologists have some thoughts about why it is, for example, that in the in Western Europe we saw the effects that we have and they were beneficial, or by the same token, a lot more difficult and problematic effects is in either northern China or in the southwestern United States, for example.
One of the problems with all of this is that we're still very much in the early stages of the study of ancient climate, or indeed modern climate. And the two big variables in the study, or the biggest variable actually, in the study of climate change today and the future and in the past, are the very complex interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere. And these, particularly in the context of El Nino and the phenomenon called the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is another seesaw of pressure in the Atlantic which affects European climate, are very little understood. And one of the most urgent priorities for climatologists is to try and unravel the mysteries of these. And the issue of climate change is intimately connected to this. And as far as warming is concerned, the causes of the medieval warm are still little known. They may be connected with a very minor tilt in the Earth's axis. The question of questions for the future is this warming? And we've seen this, we now know enough to know that the effects of even very minor warming in the medieval warm were quite major on some societies. And this, when I started looking at it beyond Europe, really shook me because I didn't realize it was so widespread. But if you take today's equations where you have anthropogenic global warming, it is clear that any effects we see in the medieval warm are presumably going to be exaggerated in a warmer future. The question of questions climatologically, of course, is to what extent has the release of fossil fuels and so on tipped the natural cycle? For example, in the fullness of time, if things are unaffected by human activity, we will one day go back into an ice age, long after you and I are pushing daisies up. But it will happen. But the question of questions is, have in fact humans overruled this natural cycle? The answer to that question is, we don't know. Yeah. I personally am sick and tired of these endless arid debates, and it's amazing watching my email. You write a book on climate, and like clockwork, people come and they, how dare you not espouse global warming, or how dare you suggest humans do it? People want you to take sides. There are, in my judgment, two issues. Mm-hmm. One, we are living in a period of warming. Most important of all, how do we live with it? How do we ensure the future of humanity in a warming world? And related to that, of course, is another most urgent problem, a long-term problem. How do we solve the problem of global warming, which is enormously expensive and difficult? And these are the two issues we should focus on. I don't think we should focus on these endless arid debates as to whether humans caused it or not. I think that's a certainty at this point, and most climatologists I talk to have moved on beyond that question to more fundamental questions.
Yeah, and I suppose, and not to draw this out too much more, but I suppose indeed people will point to the fact that following this period that we're talking about, following the medieval warm period, there was in fact a period of cooling. This is the period that's known as the Little Ice Age. So I suppose for those people who want to argue that all we're talking about here is some kind of natural cycle, that they would toss that out and say, well, sure, there was this period of warming, but look what happened after that. There was a period of cooling.
Oh, yes, indeed, indeed. And my emails, I wrote this thing, a book called The Little Ice Age, some years ago. My mail, like clockwork, it came in, are you aware that people are using your book to support X theory or Y? And you sit there and yawn. The whole climate change issue has been absolutely obscured by regiments of self-styled visionaries who think they're God or prophets, by people who have political agendas, when the real issue is, how do we live with it? How do we handle it? How do we change or try and affect human effects on climate? And those are the issues that excite me, not avid debates as to whether it was warmer today or in 1,000 years ago.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Brian Fagan. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California. He has written a good deal on the interactions of climate and human society, including the book that he just mentioned, The Little Ice Age, also the book that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's published by Bloomsbury Press and takes a look at what was happening around the world, roughly speaking, from the 10th to the 15th centuries, when there was a rise in average temperature, and it had effects all over the world. In some places, you could argue, as in Western Europe, you could argue that the effects were beneficial. And other places, like the southwestern United States, they were dealing with prolonged periods of drought that had very significant effects on the societies and the civilizations that were living there, and also places in Latin America. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We've talked about this, but I guess, again, I want to go back to what I think is a central idea that you're trying to put across, and that is, when we talk about the potential effects of global climate change, one of the most serious issues, but perhaps also one that is subtle, maybe not very dramatic, it moves quietly, but certainly has very significant implications, is drought and the possibility of prolonged and severe droughts in localized, in particular, well, fairly large areas.
Drought is really a subject that I find extraordinarily is so neglected. Hmm. If you look at the debates over global warming and the popular preoccupations, they mostly revolve around melting ice sheets and around rising sea levels, the possibility of more extreme climatic events. Fair enough. These are important events and things we should rightly be concerned about. What, however, I find startlingly absent from much of the debate is drought. And the reason, although, of course, water authorities, for example, are well aware of the problem, pollution, shortages of water, snow melt, sucking out groundwater and so on, with huge cities like Tucson and Phoenix and so on, what I find extraordinary is that in the debates over warming, the real silent villain is drought. Mm. And when I was researching this book, and the purpose of writing this book wasn't to say, here is what we know about the great warming. It is to say, hey, here is something fascinating, we need to do research on it. And the purpose of the book, ultimately, is to trigger and encourage research on these issues. Because one of the things that came out, when I started looking at computer models for future drought, I came across a series of studies by the Hadley Institute in London, near London, which is a series of very sophisticated computer models, state-of-the-art, and the Hadley is first-rate, projecting drought for the year 2100. And they project that at the moment something like 3% of the Earth's surface is subject to extreme drought. They're reckoning that figure will go up to between 18 and 30%. And that the percentage of the Earth's surface that will be subject to serious drought is going to be something like 40 or 50%. And these figures are frightening, because the places where they have the most effect, potentially, are semi-arid and arid lands. Not only Nevada, Utah, California, or the Southwest, but huge swaths of the world which are semi-arid or dry. The Sahara, much of southern Africa, much of China, Mongolia, the list goes on and on. And a great deal of these areas lie in the developing world. And I think one of the reasons there has not been a real concern about drought is that we live curiously isolated lives from the realities of the environment, living as we do in large communities. Secondly, a great deal of the drought is going to affect not us, but them, the people in the third world. And we're far more less in tune with the developing world in the United States than people are in Europe. And these figures have caused far more concern in Europe than they have over here. The point is that two centuries ago, something like 250 million people lived in agriculturally and pastorally marginal lands around the world. Today, the figures are in the billions. You're looking at a very, very, very long-term serious problem indeed. And the trouble with drought is that it's insidious. It creeps up on you. For example, last year in California, we had virtually no rain in many places. Here in Santa Barbara, we had about 4 inches. But this year, we had about 16, which is pretty near average, maybe a little low. And my goodness me, in the papers you already see, is the drought over? Well, it's not, because we live in semi-arid lands, and we've built on them a civilization which depends on lots of water. Let's take a trivial example. Let's say we really get short of water. How are you going to play golf? And that's a silly example, but it isn't, because a lot of people play golf, and it uses a lot of water. Are we going to still have lawns? What about agriculture? The list goes on and on. These are quiet, insidious, long-term problems, and the only way to solve them is by modifying social behavior and by a great deal of very careful water conservation and innovation, which involves not just people interested in water, but every single one of us.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was the frightening message of the Great Warming.
Well, then, and I think that certainly more and more people are starting to at least think about their water use. In the West, people have had to think about that for some time, but now I think there are other regions of the country, in the Midwest, for example, in the Southeast, that people are starting to think more and more about how they use water and the fact that it is not an infinite resource. So there, at least there's some possibility for more sensible water management. But some of the other parts of the world that you're talking about, it makes it sound as if some of these very arid regions where there are large populations, if indeed things pan out, as some of the research suggests, that would make these regions essentially uninhabitable.
Indeed. There are a number of sides to this. Month ago, we had a rainstorm here. And I was driving along the road, and I was in a suburban neighborhood, and about two or three houses had their sprinklers going off in the middle of a rainstorm. There are a lot of changes that have got to come. The good news is that a lot of people are getting a little more conscious of it, but certainly government is not taking a lead to really push this as a priority, because it really is something terribly important. It's very fundamental to us. In the developing world, we have another problem, and that is that these people are living at the subsistence level for the most part, and there is no infrastructure, no investment to bring in food, very little of it. The logistics are terrible, and in many of these areas, thanks to improved medical care and goodness knows what, are carrying much higher populations, and the solutions to these problems have not really been thought through. The thing that frightens me and a lot of other people, I understand, is if you get a really savage drought, you're going to get the classic behavior in the face of famine, which is people moving to find food. And what will happen if you get thousands of people moving, for the sake of argument, into Texas looking for food because there is none in their homeland? This could happen, and it could make a mockery of borders. I sound like a prophet of doom here, but these are the sort of realities that are a very remote possibility as a scenario. This is a serious, serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Fagan. He is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has written a good deal on the interaction of climate and human society. His most recent book is The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's published by Bloomsbury Press and takes a look at what was happening around the world, roughly speaking, from the 10th to the 15th century, as there was global climate change and what that meant for various places, how in some places it was positive and other places not. Questions, again, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that, some people have made this argument that when you take a look at the effects of global climate change today, that there you would say that there are some places that would consider the effects positive if what you get, for example, are longer growing seasons and perhaps milder winters, as you saw in the medieval warm period in Western Europe. And I'm and as you explained here, we're talking about a period of several hundred years, and from year to year and perhaps from decade to decade, there were ups and downs. But overall, what we see is this kind of, trend that was it was good for agriculture. It supported increase in population. It made it possible for the for there to be this flowering of civilization that perhaps led to what we would call the, High Middle Ages. I wonder, though, whether there are any lessons to be gained when you look at this period about how people behave when they think everything is great, when they in fact might engage in behaviors that over the long term you would say were actually not positive. But if you're in the middle of a period where you think everything is good, that maybe you don't think very much about what you're doing now and what that might mean 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, a century down the road.
We are, as humanity, generally short-term thinkers. Our makeup is that we are thinkers, we're planners, we're opportunists. But generally, we have always, since the beginning of history, grabbed opportunities and thought in the short term. The second thing is that we are people whose life expectancy has expanded dramatically in the last century and a half. And this gives everyone's lifetime a longer perspective. And for the first time, we, as humanity, are beginning to realize that our future depends not just on the next harvest or the death of kin or on the rule of a monarch. It depends on how we, as humans, look at the world and its problems for our children, but for our great-grandchildren and further out. And this involves great political and social courage. And believe me, in a world where everybody seems to live from one election to the next, one is not holding one's breath. It requires enormous political vision and courage to look that far ahead and to make investments and so on for the long-term future. We are, in today's industrial world, the first people, firstly, with an ability to model future climate and to look out ahead, and secondly, the first people with the ability to look at things truly globally. We can communicate. We have a much greater awareness of other societies. For example, during the late Ice Age, about, say, 20,000 years ago, probably the average human being only met at the most 40 or 50 other people, if that number. Earlier, the Neanderthals probably met a couple of dozen. Today, we meet can meet 1,000 people in a day without even trying. The whole scale of society has changed, and with it have our problems.
Let's talk with another listener, someone here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor Fagan. A question for you. Some historians that I have encountered have attributed the rise and subsequent fall of the Viking settlements of Greenland to the medieval warming and subsequent cooling. Would you like to comment on that?
Ah, yes. One of my favorite subjects. But the one thing you must realize, and this is a kind of parenthesis, but it's important, is that the image of the Vikings presented by Hollywood is largely nonsense. Forget Kirk Douglas and that ghastly 1960s movie called The Vikings with its warships and orgies. Yes, the Vikings were fierce warriors, and their society was volatile and ridden with factionalism. But they were, above all, consummate sailors and merchants. And it was their knarrs, their heavy merchant vessels, which they took voyaging over large areas of the world. And during the medieval warm centuries, there were favorable ice conditions in the north. And traveling in ice with a light Norse ship was extremely dangerous because the ships could be crushed very easily. But during the medieval war, they settled Iceland, they settled Greenland, and of course they went to North America. And much of the activity in Greenland was collecting walrus ivory, which served as the tithe they paid to the church in Norway. And after about 1200, climatic conditions in the north got much cooler. Ice conditions got more severe, and voyaging directly from Iceland to Greenland became increasingly difficult and involved long detours south into the Atlantic with corresponding rises in casualty rates. And eventually, the Norse settlements were abandoned. And the conventional view is that this was due to the severity of climate during the onset of the Little Ice Age. And there is no question that this was a major factor. However, and this is fascinating, this is brand new stuff, it's recently been suggested that one of the reasons the Norse settlements also faltered was because elephant ivory from Africa, which is soft and easily carved, became much more readily available in Europe, and the demand for walrus ivory as tithes and for trade declined. And people are wondering if, in fact, one of the reasons the Norse settlements declined was because of a fall-off in demand for walrus ivory. So it's a good lesson as to how complicated these situations are. But there's no question that falling temperatures were a major factor, particularly as the Norse were predominantly dairy people who did not want to adopt Norse fishing customs.
Thank you very much. Always as interesting, everything you say and write, Professor Fagan.
I appreciate that. That's made my day. Thank you.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We have about perhaps about 5 minutes left. I wonder if you might just talk a little bit more about human adaptability. This is something that you write about in the concluding section of the book, where you say that in spite of all of the difficult things that we have talked about, particularly the effects of these prolonged droughts, that people did indeed try to find ways to cope. Now, it might have meant the end of empires or dynasties. It might have meant the large-scale relocations of groups of people. It might indeed have meant significant declines in populations. But that people did try to the extent that they could, whether that meant moving, whether that meant trying to build water retention and irrigation systems. What does that tell you about the ability of human beings to cope with the kind of challenges that we're facing now?
This is a very good question, because I kind of got dragged screaming and yelling into contemplation of the future. My expertise is the past. But the one lesson we learn from the past is that humans are fascinating, complex people. We are born, we grow up, we fall in love, we negotiate with each other, we quarrel, we kill each other, and eventually we die. But a great deal of our lives is spent in interacting with one another and about having ideas. And one thing that scares me about all the debate about future climate change is the assumption that we will develop the technology to cope with things like warming and so on. Well, I don't think technology is really the whole thing. It's part of it. Our greatest quality of human beings is our ability to think, our ability to interact, to develop ideas, and to grab opportunities. And I think the warming world presents us with an enormous challenge. And in a world where in the future, probably the wars of the future are not going to be about trivial nationalisms or petty religious issues, they're going to be about one word, and that word is water. And I think in that world, we are going to be challenged. I think there are going to be probably a lot of casualties, but I'm very optimistic we're going to survive. I have no sympathy for these doomsday scenarios that civilization as we know it is doomed. I think we're going to survive and we're going to thrive, but it's going to be in very different ways. I think our expectations as individuals are going to change. I think our quality of life is going to change, But in the end, we will survive and prevail.
Let's try and get
like a preacher.
Let's try and get one more caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. The Gulf Stream weakened. Its figures that I just saw were about 10%, and that in some way was linked with the Little Ice Age. Was the Little Ice Age sort of this more of a regional disturbance? And in Europe, people are worried about the melting of the Greenland and the Arctic ice because of that factor, changing the pattern of heat flow from the tropics.
With good reason. Oh, yes. I mean, 12,000 years ago, there was a massive discharge of glacial ice from a glacial lake in Canada, which flowed out over the North Atlantic and very largely shut down the Gulf Stream, plunging Europe into a near-glacial period for about 1,000 years. And one of the scenarios which climatologists are watching is whether this might, ironically, be an effect of warming. And certainly European climatologists are taking this quite seriously. The whole issue of the Gulf Stream is fascinating because you really have its enormous influence on European climate, and it is very little known. Forgive me, I've lost track of what your earlier question was.
Well, I think that gets it, and there's a little time. Does La Nina and El Nino, does that affect water patterns and the transfer?
If we knew that. You mean the effects on the Atlantic? We don't know yet. They think there is a connection. They're working on it. We do know that a major El Nino means a reduced hurricane season, for example. That's a fairly close connection. I don't have the slightest doubt that there are connections between climate of El Nino and the climate of the Atlantic, but I can't give you specifics. We just don't know. So much of this we don't know yet. It's fascinating that it's beginning to emerge as a field of study.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time that we have. If you're interested in reading more on the subject, you should look for the book that we have been talking about. The title is The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's published by Bloomsbury by our guest, Brian Fagan. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Fagan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, and have a nice day in Champaign.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com. Agricultural information is made possible with support from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session, very much a mixed affair at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. Let's go ahead right to the prices in Kansas City. July wheat now is trading at $8.91, down 1.5, while September is at $9.04, up 4. At the Chicago Board of Trade, July wheat, $8.65, up 14. September, $8.78, up 10. December, $9.03, up 11.5. July corn, $7.15.5, up 6.5. September, $7.28, up 5.25. December, $7.48, up 8.5. March of 2009, $7.59, up 6.25. July beans, $15.50, up 13.5. August, $15.45.5, up 7.5. September, $15.20, down 3.5. November, $15.12, down 1.5. July soybean meal, $4.08.40, up 6.20. July soybean oil, $65.80, down 40. June live cattle, $95.82.5, up 100. August, $102.42.5, up 82.5. August feeders, $110.20, up 115. September is up 120 at 112.30. June lean hog, $73.50, up 2.5. July, $74.05, up 97.5. July bellies, $94.30, up 97.5. Outside markets for you, July crude oil, 134.40 down 234. July ethanol 270 is up 0.9. July natural gas 12.642 is down 15.6. The July RBOB 346.81 is off 57.2. Silver contract for July trading at 16.48 is off 0.5. While the gold contract for August is trading at 870, and it's down $2. The U.S. dollar is up almost 20 cents. 74.05 is the